everyone. Welcome to some new faces, some of which are whom I have met before, but perhaps they're not from this immediate area. Greetings to all of those along the line in the tape program as well. I was over in Shreveport, Louisiana, last Sabbath for a little mini campaign over there. Mr. John Pinkston and his wife came down. I think we had around 90 people or so, 95, someone told me if they counted them correctly. And I gave a sermon, as I nearly always do in life. I didn't really go into prophecy a great deal this time, but I tied it into Romans, the 8th chapter, and what God is doing here below, and the purpose in our own human physical life. And we were surprised because even though we had really a comparatively smaller turnout than we thought we would, we had quite a number of people who found out about the church and who wanted to begin attending, not only in Shreveport, where they're starting a brand new church now, but also a number of people who expressed interest in beginning to attend up in Texarkana. So I think in total we had something like 15 people that wanted to begin coming to church immediately as a result of that one trip over there to Shreveport just last week. I had hinted in a letter which I've sent out to the mailing list something that I want to announce at least preliminarily and put it on the tape program so those of you out there in certain areas, especially in the central areas of the United States, might keep this in mind. We've gotten wind that there might be some properties available, fairly reasonably available, up on Bull Shoals Lake in, extends up into Missouri, but up in Arkansas, quite a ways north of Hot Springs, it'd be about southeast a little bit of Springfield, Missouri, a little further down than Taney Como. And we flew up there to take a look at several older resort areas. To give you an idea, there was one of 8 acres with one brick house, with a guest cottage, with 3 duplexes, with a swimming pool, and access to the lake with a floating dock available for around $150,000. And I was surprised that some of those areas were that reasonable. Now, this lake will not be suitable to us for the simple reason we cannot build on it what we would like. The Army Corps of Engineers, federal regulations requiring a setback from the lake, floating facilities only. You could never have, you know, a grassy area extending down to the lake. You can never have a swimming beach. And to get ahead of myself to tell you what I'm talking about is that we've been hoping for a long time. And we had in past years even looked for properties down here on Lake Palestine, near where we live, to be able to have a summer program for the youth of the church. Now, I have a little bigger bee in my bonnet than that, and I've discussed this with some others, that if we were able to obtain facilities in an environment like that, where you had a number of buildings, like duplexes, maybe a couple of houses, and facilities, in other words, especially in a beautiful, centrally located part of the country, who knows, maybe eventually we would have a school, like an academy for the training of ministers, perhaps we would go a 2-year program. I doubt if we would ever want to start a 4-year undergraduate college the way Ambassador began clear back in 1947 when I was so much a part of it, and to go through all of that process again or not, but the idea of a centrally located site for festivals, for the other annual holy days of the church, including Pentecost, etc., for people that live within a few hundred miles of that area, not only a youth camp, but a family vacation resort run by the church where we could have seminars and so on. There are just a lot of things that we might be able to do with a facility like that. So, to those of you who might know of areas that would be at least indicative, there might be some indication that we could utilize them in that fashion, where we could offer such things as canoeing, swimming, lifeguard, life-saving techniques, water polo, hiking, horseback riding, you know, archery, all the various water sports, and dendrology, and wilderness studies, along with certain limited exposure to the Bible without making it necessarily a Bible vacation camp the way the Baptists do or something like that. At least I wanted to preliminarily let you know what our thinking has been. And we've had such a success with the camp out up here at Tyler State Park. People have come from hundreds of miles away and to become involved in that. I know the interest is there. Way back years ago when we first began the summer educational program, it was an offshoot of Imperial Schools, of which I was the superintendent. It was my idea. I had to fight for it. I had to go to bat for it in the boardroom and to undergo grueling accusations and threats of cancellation and total disinterest from the very top leadership in the church for literally decades to fight for the existence of that program for the sake of the youth of the church. It was threatened every single time we had a budget crisis, which was about every other Tuesday, with cancellation, because it was looked upon as something that was unnecessary. And I kept on arguing, when are we ever going to give something back to the people? When do the people out there who do not have the fortune, the good fortune, to live in the Southern California Basin or immediately adjacent to Big Sandy or on the Brigetwood campus, the free areas where we had colleges and high schools and so on, who are, if you look at it, taxed to support the entirety of the Imperial School program, when do these people, with their tens of thousands of children, have access to some of the educational opportunities and recreational and social opportunities that the church provides? I would love to have my two sons go to Gallaudet College. You know why? Not because they could qualify, because Gallaudet happens to be the one major and most important school at the collegiate level for the deaf. I found in their own information and their brochures, their catalogs that they send out, that the one most oft-stated reason for youngsters to go to Gallaudet College in Washington, D.C., is to, quote, meet other deaf children of their same age. And boy, do I ever understand that. Now, what do you think would be one of the primary motives for the children of the Church of God International in the teenage area of life, 14, 16, 17, and 18, to go to a summer educational program of that type where they could be for a couple of weeks with hundreds of kids their same age? Obviously, they all know about the Sabbath and the holy days. They feel a little bit, I grew up with that, they feel a little bit ostracized from sports and programs in their own schools. They are viewed as a little bit different. If any idea about the kind of religion that they're into gets out among their peer group in school, they can't really have the same social outlet. So right now, we try to do the best job we can at the Feast of Tabernacles, and of course in the one little limited summer camp program that we've had, which has been a very great success. But I think that eventually the church will be behind such a project. You know, when we started that many years ago in the early 1960s, I sent out a letter and I asked for voluntary gifts from people who had a lot of things put by that they simply didn't use anymore. You couldn't believe the number of canoes, outboards, outboard motors, paddles, skis. We must have gotten 19 or 20, 22 rifles for riflery. We got donations of bows and arrows, because there were people out here, widows, whose husbands had died, who had played golf all their lives, who sent his golf clubs and his archery set and so on, were just sitting there in the attic. And people donated, I mean, little motor generators and outboard motors and oars, and we just had equipment coming out our ears. Some of it was not usable, but some of it was. And it gave us a start in what grew to be a fabulous summer educational program for the youth of the church, which is still going right now today. Now, what we began up there by digging holes and having problems with the county health department to have outhouses has grown basically because of my energy and my defense of the project. And I was the one who ordered Ray Wright to get them a usable ski boat when they couldn't afford it. And I was also the one who ordered the building of that gymnasium up there when nobody else wanted it. And it sits there to this day. So I can simply say that because it happens to be true. But that installation up in Orr, Minnesota, growing from an undeveloped point on Lake Pelican, Pelican Lake, is probably worth somewhere around $4 million today. So it enhances the physical assets and even, in a sense, you know, the financial statement of the church. And an awful lot of that was done by volunteer labor. Families came up there. Counselors came from the local church areas. And families came along and used their vacation time to clear timber and build docks and construct roadways and to help out with carpentry and finish the interior of the areas and so on, and just did everything that needed to be done. We bought a sodding machine, which went out and actually in fields where we could lease the field for a certain amount of money, and transported truckloads of beautiful grass sod, and where it was just bare rock and so on, green lawns materialized. That was an effort, a combined effort of hundreds of people. It took place over many, many years. We didn't just go up there and buy that point the way it looks today at Orr, Minnesota. So something like that, I think, is destined to happen in the Church of God International. Well, now that isn't what I came up here to talk about. and I'm eating into my time by 10 minutes. So I'll have to keep time on the my eye on the clock. But I wanted to tell you people along the tape program to at least keep your eyes open. I had a friend who lived where I do out in Emerald Bay who received word some months ago that he had cancer. He was taken on to Mother Francis Hospital here in Tyler, and he lasted only a very few weeks. That was one of the most rapidly developing carcinomas of the lymph system that you've ever heard of, and it simply ate the man alive until he lost weight like several pounds a day, went down to where he was unrecognizable, turned to kind of a yellow parchment kind of a texture to his skin, and died. Now, my friend Art had a peculiar sounding golf cart. I could almost hear Art when he'd go by over there several fairways away. It kind of growled because there was something wrong with his golf cart. He had a very friendly, inimitable laugh, a very big belly horse laugh, kind of a grating laugh. He was kind of a humorist. Everybody thought of him as a person who loved life and loved a good joke and loved camaraderie, and he was very socially outgoing. He commuted back and forth. He was in the oil business down in Houston, but he loved Emerald Bay so much that he would drive every weekend, get in his car Friday afternoon, come roaring back up to Emerald Bay, stay there for the weekend, and then Sunday night or early Monday morning get in his car and drive to Houston again. He was wealthy enough to be able to do that. Art wanted to be cremated. So when Art died, his body was burned, and he wanted his ashes to be scattered over Emerald Bay. Well, there was a problem with the health authorities, and when they checked into that at the crematorium here in Tyler, they discovered they couldn't do that. It's illegal to dump ashes, even a little urn full of ashes, from a human body over an inhabited area. So Art's ashes were scattered at his widow's request over the center of Lake Palestine. So out where I live, some months ago, Art Kellhoffer was scattered over the lake. That is, a little urn about this big containing the earthly remains of Art Kellhoffer were scattered over the lake. Now, in the Bible, it talks about the resurrection of the dead. I got a letter the other day. A young man was wondering, how does God do this? It's a valid question. People were asking that in the day of the Apostle Paul. How can God reconstruct a body when that body has been completely decomposed? Now, of course, the traditional feeling of the Christians in the so-called Christian religion is the very comfortable feeling of the proverbial death at age 96 with grandma with her spectacles on her nose in a rocking chair who just simply goes to sleep to take a nap one afternoon the way my grandmother died and doesn't wake up. And then there is the body, completely intact. That's grandma, but she just is not talking to you anymore. She's not now vivacious. She doesn't have any more life. She's in the tomb, and you actually see the coffin being lowered into a grave, and all the flowers there, and the sermon, and people crying, and everything. And grandma is gone, but you can go to the grave like people do across the street here every single day of the week, and we see them out there in knots of 3 and 5 and 10, kneeling by a grave. Maybe the wife or the husband is actually saying a few words, "Harry, I know you're down there. I want to let you know that I'm taking care of the grave," or whatever. And the traditional feeling about death is it is very, very nice when you see a loved one has had a full and a very successful, rewarding life. They have died of old age or of some sickness, and they have been buried, and the body is intact. Now, there's no problem to a Christian knowing that the day of the resurrection of the dead is coming. In Acts 2, 3, and 4, there must be 20 different repetitive statements where the Apostle Peter and others are saying, Christ was crucified, that Christ died, and that God raised him from the dead. He talks about the resurrection of the dead, talks about how David was buried, and his sepulcher is with us unto this day, and that David is not ascended into the heavens, talks about the resurrection of the dead. In the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation, very interesting scriptures, I saw thrones, verse 4, they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the lives, the Greek is psuche, meaning the beings or the lives of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead, billions of human beings, all the ones we were hearing about in the sermonette in Ethiopia, in Chad, Dahomey, Niger, the Sudan, all across Africa, the people dying now in the riots and the melee in South Africa, and people dying all around the world. Every time the world turns, thousands, tens of thousands of human lives perish. We saw sickeningly on television news just this morning of how blacks beat another black woman to death because allegedly she was a police informer, and we had to see a human female body covered partially by sticks and faggots on fire, with those young blacks still throwing sticks and stones and battering an inert, lifeless, burning human body in the streets of one of these black townships in South Africa. All these people, the Chinese we talk of who have never heard the name of Jesus Christ, the Japanese or the Shintoist or the Buddhist religion, are included in this statement. The rest of the dead live not again until the 1,000 years are finished. And so is my friend Art Kelhofer. He's included in that statement too. This, referring back, because really the first part of verse 5 is a parenthetical statement, this, meaning the thrones and judgment given to those who lived and reigned with Christ, is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy, interesting language, is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. But you see, those who come up in the second resurrection are not called blessed and holy. And when you look at what this verse doesn't say, it doesn't say that the second death does have power over them. Art Kelhofer is dead, but the second death still has power over my friend Art Kelhofer, because he still has not exercised his option. He still has not made a decision. He was not one of those who really knew and understood the truth, and he was not called in this time. A little point of new understanding we might make that I think is important. There's another great reason why those who are going to be brought up in the first resurrection, meaning this age, or meaning the dispensation of the church, are blessed and holy in a unique way, that those, even if they do exercise their option and make the right decision during the judgment, called the Great White Throne Judgment in the latter part of this chapter, and if they are inducted into the kingdom of God, they will do so at a different time, and they will not do so in the context, believe it or not, of the church. That's right. Because the age, the dispensation of the church, the very need and the requirement for the church ceases at the time of the establishment of the kingdom of God on this earth. The church is the advance emissarial group. The church represents ambassadors for the future coming kingdom and government of God. And once the government of God is in place, there are no more ambassadors. It now rules every place, everywhere, over all the world. Uniquely, then, we learn lessons in the configuration of the church, and we are called blessed and holy, headed toward either one of two things, as we read in 1 Corinthians 15, being instantaneously, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, changed at the last trump, or being resurrected to live and to reign with Christ for 1,000 years. At that time, at the second coming of Christ, the dispensational age of the church is over. Now the church, which is really an analogy of the great body of Jesus Christ, which will expand to include the entirety of all those who are the dead in Christ, and eventually all those who, in every single age, every 100 years, every day, somewhere, people will have reached 100 years of age in the millennial reign of Christ and will be immediately changed in the same way that we will be changed if we are alive and remain, to become a part of the kingdom of God all through the millennial age, but under the government of God. Not under Satan, not in a world where the pulls and tugs of Satan the devil reign supreme, and where almost like the little whisper you heard described in the sermonette, here and there, in a very quiet manner, some individual set of circumstances, some almost accidental happenstance that you may trace back in your life that led you to turn the radio on or to see or to hear a telecast or to come across a relative who handed you a piece of literature or to have a tragedy in your life that caused you to search for some of the truth or to discover something in the Bible or whatever. And in that fashion, many of us can point to the way in which we came into the knowledge of the true Church of God. And we had to swim upstream against an awful lot of opposition. In the millennium, no opposition, no Satan the devil, no pulls and tugs of a carnal, frustrating, hate-filled, racist, brutal society that provides every excuse not to accept the government of God. So the age of the church is over. And perhaps you had not thought of that in that way before. Recently, my father wrote a very long and a very powerful letter that he published in the front page of the Worldwide News, a newspaper that I started many years ago. Also, he has written another letter, which we have heard, and he has voiced very grave concern that there are those unidentified, I suspect he may include me in this, although I don't know why, who are, quote, waiting for him to die. And he has been very vociferous with close personal friends lately, angrily so, about leaving all that he has built up to someone who will come along after him. Now I have said, meaning no recriminations or no dishonorable statements toward my father, that it is simply axiomatic that dictators do not groom successors. There are benevolent dictators, there are kind dictators. God's government is a benevolent dictatorship, if you want to look at it that way. So I do not use that term in its harshest sense. I use it in its sense of classic governmental description of an autocracy. Why don't they? Well, because if they were to name a successor while they are yet alive, they are merely triggering the potential of a coup d'etat. They are naming someone who is going to supersede them, to whom people are already beginning to shift loyalties. And they worry about that because they worry about overthrow. Back in the Psalms, in Psalm the 49th chapter, David said, "Hear ye this, all you people, and give ear, you inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor. My mouth will speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will open mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the harp." And he was playing this upon the harp. "Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity of my heel shall compass me about?" David was talking about faith as versus the fear of the grave, fear of death, fear of what would transpire when he got old. "They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul," and again in the Hebrew it is ruach, meaning their life, their being, "is precious, and it ceases forever. That he should still live forever," going back before the parenthetical insert, "none can by any means with all of his money redeem his brother, nor can he live forever and not see corruption. For he sees that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish, and leave their wealth to others." Their inward thought is, this is profound, that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Men like to build masterpieces, buildings, institutions. An artist likes to leave a mural 120 feet long on a big public building. An architect like a Frank Lloyd Wright likes to leave sensational, ultra-modernistic looking, outstanding buildings dotting a landscape. There are people who put forth a great deal of energy in creativity, inventiveness, ingenuity, construction, during their lives, who make certain contributions to the lives of others. Great musicians are often not recognized until long after they are dead. Same is true oftentimes of artists and others, because tastes change. But in all places at all times, most very dynamic, powerful, self-made men, men of dynamism, men of education, men of inventiveness, of ingenuity, men of creativity, as they get very, very old, as one very close personal friend told me concerning his own father, and they see death approaching, they developed what he described as an inner rage. There is something that begins to develop inside of them that says, this isn't fair. Look what I have accomplished. Look what I have done. Look at all of these magnificent things that have been accomplished. It isn't fair that I should have to depart and leave all of this to someone else. Now let's discuss our masterpiece for a minute. I like to paint. I like to dabble in paints. It chagrined me one time when I gave a group of my paintings to a friend to sell, and then because I think he had to move on, he discovered there was a little church effort underway to try to get some money for a personal appearance campaign or something, and so he decided when they were having a kind of a garage sale for the church collectively to take about 15 or 20 of my paintings and give them there to that, and they sold who knows where and they're gone forever. And I really did like a couple of them. I had one with a white-tailed deer jumping over a fence in the snow and 100 way back in the distance. I had another one of a kind of a desert Grand Canyon scene and so on. I wish I knew where those were. One of my paintings graces the lounge in a resort up called Nelson's Resort on Crane Lake in Minnesota. It's a picture of a huge flume between two lakes, and there's the ancient old machinery there in the background, and several boats turn up on the shore, and a beautiful lake, and some of the big, huge trees up there, the white birch bark trees and so on. I'd like to get my hands on that painting. I'd like to have that one back. I've given away some that I've really enjoyed, given away a lot of them that I wouldn't care to get back. And I'm sure there are many of them in persons' closets whom, if I said I was coming to visit, they'd dust them off real quick and stick them on the wall. But I would like to perform, I would like to really create a really great masterpiece, because I look at this magazine called Southwestern Art, or I look at real art, and I compare it with my rather, you know, inane and amateurish dabblings, and I stand in awe of the talent and the incredible ability of some of these artists who can actually paint paintings where you can see a picture of that painting and you will have to look almost with a microscope to determine that is not one of the most sharply focused, beautiful 35 millimeter photographs you ever saw in your life. So realistic it just takes your breath. I'd love to be able to do that. But now, if you had an opportunity to create your greatest masterpiece of all, and that would be to clone yourself. If you had an opportunity to create a better you, you love you. I know you do. Don't argue with me. I'm not going to listen to you. I don't care what you say. I don't care how big you are. I don't care what your color, the texture of your skin. I don't care how old you are. I don't care what your interests are in life. I don't care what your race is. I don't care anything about any of that. How big or how little your nose, how tall or how short, how fat or how skinny, you love yourself. You'd be crazy if you didn't. The Bible says no man ever yet hated his own flesh, and I'll just go with that. The Bible says so. Besides that, Jesus Christ says that we're only required to love our neighbors as ourselves. So you love yourself. Sure you do. I do. I love myself. If I didn't have self-love and self-respect, how could I have love for other people? If you don't love yourself, if you hate yourself, you're going to hate other people too. All right, you love yourself. But you like to make improvements. I would. I got little pains here and there. Shoulders hurt. Little arthritis creeping into the hands. My lower back hurts. My right hip and knee tie up. Got a sciatic problem. Besides that, some of my hair is falling out. It's turning gray. I'm a little older than I used to be. And that bugs me. That bothers me. Now, I'd like to get busy on my greatest masterpiece. That's to clone myself. So that when I die, I don't really have to die. It's just a transitional period, and boom, the clone stands up, and it's me all over again, but I'm 19 again. And I got the same body I had when I was 19, man. I mean, nice upper body and all of that, a little stronger by far, well, a lot stronger than I am today. I could hit a golf ball a lot further then than I can today. I'd like to get busy on my greatest masterpiece, which is to clone myself. To have a replica, but I've got a lot of imperfections. I never liked my nose very much. My brother used to say I had a knob for a nose, and he was right. We used to kid each other about our noses. I never could stand my feet. I'd like to have pretty feet, you know, good, nice-shaped feet, like the ads for athlete's foot on TV. A good-looking foot, not my foot. And I've got ugly feet. A lot of things about my body I don't like. I've got, of course, I'd like to have the tattoos removed. Like to have that done. Now, you start thinking about yourself. If you were going to clone yourself and reproduce yourself so that you could live on, yourself could live on and have another new lifetime ahead of you, you'd make some refinements and improvements, wouldn't you? I always wanted to be about 6 foot six or seven. I wanted at least once in my life to dunk a basketball. Now, in my next life, I know that God will allow me to do that, but maybe this time I can take Mars and dunk it through a hoop in the outer ring of Venus or something like that. But you want to be able to do things that you never could do. Now, how are we going to go about the greatest masterpiece of all, which is to be able to clone ourselves, to contribute somehow in our own effort to leaving behind something a lot more important than a building with our name on it, something a lot more interesting than just a painting that people say, oh, Garner Ted painted that. Wow, he was a good artist. Yeah, but he's dead. What good's that doing? You know, there are people over there in that, right across that street, there are people over there. If you knew about their lives and what they had done and things they'd accomplished, the homes they lived in, some of the bric-a-brac and the fine old antiques they'd collected, or somebody over there probably had a 1924 silver ghost that was perfectly restored or something. They're probably oil men and their widows. There are people over there that caught 14-pound bass in Florida. You'd say, wow, look at that. Human physical beings talk about what we are. When we're born as little children, we gradually come up in the world and we learn what it looks like on top of the table and on top of the sewing machine and on top of the dresser. It takes us years to do that because we have little kids right here right now that know more about the bottom of that chair than you do. You never look at the bottom of a chair in 20 or 30 years, most of you. They know more about insects like crickets crawling around a rug than you do because you don't pay any attention to them. The kids are fascinated. Goes a cricket, and they're looking at them. They know more about how much chewing gum there is underneath the seat in the theater than you do because you never have felt under there like a kid will to find out whether any of it's still usable, or I'm just kidding. But when we grow up, we go to school as little children, they hand us some books, and the books are how big and how far and how wide and how old and how small. You remember some of those? It's always how big and how small. And so they show us, well, here's a man, and then here's a horse, and here's an elephant, and there's a tree, and then there's the Statue of Liberty. And we get relative sizes, and we learn about ourselves. And we learn about biology, chemistry, geology, astronomy, mathematics. We learn in some of these studies in high school how our human physical eye works, that it actually goes inverted and upside down, that our brain sees it upside down. I'm seeing you upside down. But my brain thinks I'm seeing you right side up, but my eye is actually reversing or inverting your image, and my brain reads it right side up. And the experiment of the guy who took the glasses that actually reversed it the other way and wore them for months and months and months. I've seen a documentary film on that. And then finally, he got to where instead of people walking around the ceiling, he was seeing people walking around the floor. He reversed his brain process, took the glasses off, and they looked like binoculars turned around backwards, a big metal thing. I've seen the documented film on it. And suddenly he was seeing everybody up. He was now the naked eye, and he was seeing everybody upside down again. And he went through this sickening, nauseous experience. He would throw up and everything of trying to get his mind back to where he's seeing people right side up again. We learn these things about ourselves. Man is this. Man is a complete self-contained power plant available in a variety of sizes, shapes, and colors, reproducible in almost unlimited quantity, relatively long-lived, with major components in duplicate. We are waterproof, amphibious, operate on a wide variety of fuels. We have thermostatically controlled cooling and heating systems. We have sealed, self-lubricated bearings inside us. We have audio and optional direction and range finders, sound and sight recording, audio and visual communication apparatus, and we're equipped with an automatic control center. And we even have self-repairing facilities inside of our bodies. And we have a brain. But we have more than that. We also have a spiritual quantity. We have a spirit. We have a mind, and that mind is partly spirit essence. And they have now demonstrated by kinetic photography, kinetic energy, that we human beings have a kind of an aura about us. There are some strange tests which indicate that you can actually feel. I felt this just a time or two in my life. I stopped dead short and reached out, and sure enough, there was the door. I got up in pitch black, strange room, motel someplace. I'm going to the bathroom. I was just about that far from walking into the door when my forehead got all prickly, my skin got all prickly. So I learned how to do that. You don't do it this way. Don't ever go down the hallway that way. I learned a long time ago to go down the hallway that way. Link your hands in front of you, and then you don't walk straight into the dumb door, you see. Because if you don't link your hands, you're going to walk right into the door. So I don't walk into the door anymore. I go down the hallway like that. It can't get at me unless it comes through my hand. I bet you never thought of that, did you? How many of you now? Come on, tell me the truth. How many of you have thought of that? You haven't thought of it. See, new truth all the time here. We learn that man is able to project electrical energy from his brain. Now, I cannot explain why a twin completely half a world away from his twin will know immediately when the twin dies or has some terrible thing that happens. Why a wife in the war will sit up, bolt upright in the middle of the night, scream out her husband's name, and know the instant that he dies. I don't even pretend to be able to fathom and to pass on to you why that is. Suffice it to say that this spiritual property of our material mind has fabulous capabilities and properties we do not really understand. None of us do. There is a spirit in man. That part of us that we call will, volition, or personality is where we really dwell, the spirit in man. Now, I want to talk about microcosm and macrocosm. In the macrocosm of the universe, without taking a lot of time on that, we know that there are billions of huge galaxies, and that each galaxy is composed of perhaps billions of stars, and that most of those billions of stars are bigger by far than our sun. Our sun is an orange dwarf, expending energy at a monumental amount, 99.99 some odd hundredths, more than that, percent of which is lost into the blackness of space. One tiny little bit of that energy giving off in all directions at all times through all of these thousands and billions of years as our orange dwarf continues to burn comes to the Earth, a little pinprick out here where our Earth absorbs that much sun. We say, oh, it's hot today. Boy, I'll tell you, if you were a few million miles closer, it'd be a lot hotter. We're just at the right distance from the sun so we don't burn to a crisp every single day. Now, with just that brief rehearsal of how vast and how big it is out there, that it would take you 55 years at the speed of light to get to Aldebaran, and that's only in our own immediate solar neighborhood, outside of the solar system of our stellar neighborhood, I should say, the nearest star to us, that it is a vastness beyond our comprehension. Let's come down into the microcosm. You are composed of matter. My glasses are matter. This pulpit up here is matter. The microphone is matter. My necktie is matter. So is the air I'm breathing. It's composed of matter. Well, anciently, the Greeks knew that matter occupies space and has weight. It doesn't necessarily have shape because hydrogen gas and oxygen are also matter because they've got substance and they have properties that are chemically and physically traceable, and you can actually analyze them. The ancient Greek philosophers speculated, and they said that all things accounted for, this is over 600 years before Christ, all things are accounted for, that is physical material things, by innumerable small hard particles. They could see that rocks could be reduced to sand, and they could see that human beings could be cremated, and they could see that there were physical properties of various sort of metals, because you know the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, the age of metallurgy. A lot of you in this room, including me, don't know very much about what it takes to find certain of these ores. You might not recognize copper ore if you saw it, or iron ore. You wouldn't recognize maybe aluminum as opposed from tin, or tin as opposed from some other substance. And then how to get it out of the rocks, both chemically and by heat, and then how to blend some of these metals together until you get malleable and durable types of materials that you can make into swords and spears. Man usually does it, you know, making them into metals that are for killing instead of metals for peaceful purposes. That would be something else again, but they knew this in the ancient times. And so, hundreds of years before Christ, thousands of years, they speculated that all things in matter are from innumerable small hard particles of various sizes and shapes, but made of one basic material called atoms. And the Greek word atom merely means structureless, without structure, shapeless, and therefore featureless. The word atom means structureless. That's all it means, the word atom. Well, centuries and centuries went by until clear up into the 1800s. A Russian chemist named Dmitry Mendeleev discovered in 1869 that if, strikingly, and this is fascinating, seven elements of this earth listed in order of increasing atomic weight were lined up in that order, their atomic weight, that an amazing repetitious regularity began to occur, involving the periodic reoccurrence of similar sequences of elements in nature as we find them. Why? And why seven? And so in the sequence of lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine, it runs from the first of those, the very reactive element lithium, which forms positive ions, to the highly active element fluorine, or fluorine, which forms negative ions. In the same sequence, the next sequence of seven elements, it goes from sodium, magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, and chlorine, and displays exactly the same properties as the first. Now this man, clear back in 1869, by careful observation of the sequence throughout the periodic table of elements, Mendeleev was able to predict the existence and properties of several elements that were even unknown then, such as gallium, scandium, and germanium, which is used with titanium in aerospace for an extremely durable, very highly tensile strength and so on, and lightweight metal, stronger than steel. Now, they finally began to realize that all physical matter is made up of molecules, and the molecular structure of matter basically is the smallest divisible particle, retaining the physical properties of the matter from which it came, and that these in turn are made up of billions of atoms. There are 90 or so different atomic elements that occur in nature, and about 20 or so have been made by man. Atoms are so small that, to give you an idea of how tiny an atom is, one teaspoon of water would contain 500 sextillion. Now, sextillion is million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, sextillion, so you get an idea of how many of those. In other words, that's 5 times 10 to the 23rd power, or 5 followed by 23 zeros. There are that many atoms in a teaspoon of water, atoms in water. And each atom, as we go from the macrocosm down to the microcosm, looks like and acts like a tiny solar system. The nucleus of the atom represents 99.95% of its mass. Well, actually, our solar system is, if you took the sun in the comparable size of all the other bodies that are here and put them all together and looked at their mass, is somewhat the same with the sun as the nucleus by comparison. And of course, we know that atoms are composed of electrons, neutrons, protons. Fritz Kahn, a famous physicist, wrote this, and I quote, "In contrast to its small size, the nucleus is incredibly heavy. If a drop of dew were made entirely of nuclear mass, it would be 130 trillion times heavier than it is now, composed of water molecules. A solid lump of nuclei, the size of one lump of sugar, you just got the nucleus of atoms now, instead of an atom in its entirety, which is mostly what? Mostly space. Think about it. Each atom, as many as there are in a teaspoon of water, is mostly space, with little electric charges going at lightning speed around a nucleus. So if you took away the space and you got down to the mass and you're only measuring the nuclei of these atoms, it would be so incredibly heavy that a solid lump of nuclei the size of a little white lump of sugar would weigh 24 billion kilograms or 26 million tons. That's its atomic weight, and that's equivalent to 552,000-ton battleships. The nuclei of those atoms, if reduced, taking away all the space, to the size of a cube of sugar, would weigh as much as 500 battleships. Now, atoms are mostly empty space. with 1 to 100 electrons orbiting about the nucleus. And Kahn says this about that: despite the vastness of the atom, it is extremely difficult to press one atom against another or to compress the orbits of the electrons. Electrons revolve 6 × 10^15 times a second, or 6 quintillion times a second around a nucleus. How fast is that? Our aircraft propellers go approximately 2200 RPM, revolutions per second, to take us through the air. A system with such a quotient of rotation is harder than steel, no matter how small a mass or how great the distances. An atom behaves like a propeller, making 1,000,000 revolutions a second. Now, if you calculate that if all the atoms that comprise matter that makes up the Earth, devoid of space, now you go down, take away the space, and look at just the nuclei, shrunk to the appropriate size, then the world on which we stand would be a small ball, harder than steel by 1,000,000 times, 6 miles in diameter. So much for the microcosm, but one more quote or two here, so you get the point. Kahn says that since the protons are all equally charged, they strongly repel each other. If the 20 protons or more inside the nucleus of the iron atom were liberated from their bonds, they would fly apart with a pressure of 7 × 10^15 atmospheres, an atmosphere being the average air pressure at sea level, or about 15 pounds per square inch. The released energy corresponds to a temperature of more than 100 million degrees. Vehemence of action, and million degree heat are the nuclear energy we gain by the fissioning of the nuclei of atoms, or as is generally expressed, nuclear reaction. So Einstein's theory revealed that there's a tremendous amount of energy stored up in matter. That 1 ounce of matter, 1 ounce of water, or any other matter, contains the energy equivalent of 750 million kilowatts of electrical power, or 625,000 tons of TNT. Just 1 ounce of matter, be it this wood or my thumb, contains that kind of energy. And Kahn says this: since energy is liberated when an atom nucleus is split, energy must have been invested in the nucleus. It had to come from someplace. It had to get there somehow. And then he says, we do not know how nuclei originated. To combine 26 positively charged protons into a unit requires an energy of billions of degrees of heat and a pressure of more than 7 × 10^18 atmospheres. Even in its fieriest days, listen to this admission, the Earth never could furnish such power, nor could the sun, nor could any star. There is no power in the nuclear furnaces powering the universe today which could have created matter. Matter is endowed with an infusion of power which would require greater temperature and greater atmospheric density than is available through the heat at the core of the sun. Therefore, a great creator had to produce both the microcosm, which is like a little universe inside of every atom, and the macrocosm, which is the vastness of the universe itself. Now, I'm composed of all of those atoms, and working away inside of my head at this moment, by some process or other, as I look at the notes that I have tried to carefully put together today in preparation for this sermon for you, is a brain, a mind. That brain is right now interrogating and calling upon little cells all over it, which go way back 30-some years to all the studies that I've had in Ambassador College and other studies and reading and so on that I've done in the past. It is also thinking about what I studied, looked into, and researched in preparation for this message today. My eye is working, I'm standing on my feet, my lungs are working, my hands are almost automatically attuned to what I'm saying, so I make certain gesticulations with my hands and arms, and I am up here occupying space, having a certain shape, a certain weight, a certain appearance, and I am made of vast energy which actually could produce an explosion which could wipe out half of the state of Texas. If my body could be converted from this flesh and blood and bone into the nuclear energy that it took to compose it, I could obliterate half of the state of Texas if I would just explode. Now, I don't intend to do that. I've seen people explode, but they don't explode in the way that I'm talking about. Also, a part of the atomic structure of my brain is something which cannot be found in a chemical laboratory, and it is called spirit. It is a spiritual quantity of some sort. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter. The Apostle Paul is dealing with the resurrection. There were people there who, for some strange reason, we've had this problem in the church in recent months, began to preach some false doctrines, got a new idea, and said, oh no, you're wrong, there is no resurrection of the dead. And like my letter that I got the other day, people ask questions and they say, now look, suppose a man died and he were a sailor and he were buried at sea. And they just put a weight in there in a canvas bag and down goes his body. Well, eventually sharks discover him and they eat his body. And the sharks swim around, and he is being digested by a pack of about 100 different sharks. And the sharks' bodies assimilate the flesh and blood that was once this man. And then it gets into their vital organs. And let's say this is a great white, and he is caught, and his liver is taken, and that liver is processed to make oils that is put in little capsules and eaten by people who are very much into the diet thing of EPA or whatever. Or maybe also the liver is actually sold in the meat market, or some of these big sharks that are sold as white fish are simply cut up and other people eat the fish. Now here's a fish that partly has certain part of its cellular structure that is coming from a man who died out there. Now you eat the fish and the fish becomes part of you. So part of that man is now part of you somehow. Now how does God do that? I mean, God has got to get back all of that and go through the process, doesn't he, the fish, and then all the way back to the original man and put him all back together again, doesn't he? How does God do that? People ask this question. In 1 Corinthians 15 we read the Apostle Paul said, some will ask, verse 35, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Now, Paul thought it was a foolish question. I was asked the question in a letter just the other day. Thou fool, that which you sow is not enlivened except it die. It requires death for a grain of wheat, so that the one little germ of life, because it's only a tiny little part of the grain of wheat, all the rest of the grain of wheat dies, it decays. But there's one little tiny infinitesimal part of the grain of wheat that is still alive, and that's the germ. Now, by analogy, a seed from a carrot plant, if it grows up, you know, and it gets kind of woody looking, and finally a great big thick stalk comes up, it's that little green frond you see, and out of that a kind of a frond or a fern or a head develops on the top of that, and then little tiny seeds will come out of that. And they're shaped like little tiny fingernail clippings. Any of you ever plant carrots? Am I thinking lettuce? Lettuce looks like fingernail clippings, but carrots do too. They're little tiny kind of elongated little quarter moon shape. And you sow them, and then that little tiny seed. Now, I could take the most powerful microscope and look at it. I could take a razor blade and I could take it all apart and try to find where's the little nucleus here. But that seed decays. Now, a lot of you have watched a bean pod. Bean pod is easier to watch because you can even do that in water, just a little bit of soil next to the glass. You take the bean and you see it kind of swell. First it takes a lot of the liquid and it starts to decay, and then it kind of splits, and then lo and behold, those two segments where a bean always, you know, falls in half kind of become the outer hull of two big leaves. And pretty soon that just kind of springs out of the ground, and here is a divided leaf in two, and then out of that begins the bean plant. Well, from this one little bean, finally you can have a plant that will go way up above your head and go all along a wall out here and tie it up and be hanging out there in bunches of hundreds and hundreds of beans, reproducing itself thousands of times over by the time you hauled them all from just one bean that you put in the ground. And there was some little infinitesimal spark of life in that body which died and decayed, and that decaying body became fuel for that spark of life. But there was a pattern there. Science can't tell you why, how it got there, how that plant knows to assimilate and to actually structure itself in its molecular cellular structure as it grows and develops in exactly the pattern of the parent plant. But it does. How? Well, it's a mystery. In the same way, it's a mystery that we human beings can reproduce after our own kind, and that a human father and a human mother can actually be in the process, as they are in marriage, becoming parents, of recreating, cloning, if you will, in a sense, themselves, but it's not really them. It's a separate human being looking just like them. Well, Paul goes on to say, in answer to this question, that which you sow, you don't sow the body that shall be, but bare grain, might be a wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as it has pleased him, and to every seed his own body. All flesh is not the same flesh. There's one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of beasts, another of fishes, another of birds. There are also celestial bodies and bodies terrestrial, mountains and so on. But the glory of the celestial is one, as we gaze at it at night and look at it with our binoculars. And the glory, the beauty of this earth, the terrestrial, is another. There's one glory of the sun, bright, brilliant, blinding. Another of the moon, kind of quiet, soft, remote, distance, with a certain allure and romantic attachment to it. And another glory of the stars, vast, remote, distant, twinkling, icy, cold, almost forbidding, and yet not cold really, but huge suns up there, billions of light years and parsecs away. For one star differs from another star in glory, so also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, ugly, corrupt, corroding, stinking even. Flesh decays. When it does, it smells, gives off an odor. And we are flesh, and we will do that. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, dead, inert, lifeless, no strength left, couldn't lift an elbow if it tried. It's dead, inert. But it is raised in power, energy again, power. It is sown a natural body, a physical body. It is raised a vibrant, blinding, brilliantly lit, beautiful, spiritual body. There is a natural body. Where is it? What's it look like? You're inhabiting it. You're sitting in it. It's you. Like old Stan Freberg said, you gotta have skin. Skin's the only thing, you know, that keeps your insides in. Skin is what you feel at home in. Without it, both your liver and your abdomen would keep falling on the floor and you'd be dressed in your intestine. And yours fits you and mine fits me. And he goes on and on about, you gotta have skin. You're living inside your skin. There is a physical body. Where is it? Where you live, you're it, you're in it, you inhabit it. There is a spiritual body. Now, why haven't we looked at that in past years? It doesn't say there will be. It says there is a spiritual body. Now, I submit to you today that the greatest masterpiece upon which we ought to be working is Jesus Christ of Nazareth in us, carefully sketching, constructing, drawing, building, feeding, if you will, through the spiritual mechanism of listening to sermons, studying the Bible, getting on our knees and praying, helping, serving, sharing, living a Christian life in exemplary acts and deeds, not just in things we say. That in the same way as you ingest and imbibe food into your mouth, which gradually is assimilated by your digestive system and becomes a part of the fuel that adds to your cells and makes you what you are physically, so as you ingest and imbibe the Holy Spirit of God, you are actually, in a sense, cloning, to use that analogy, a spiritual body. And what you are leaving behind is that better, brighter you. The you that can do all the things you wanted to do, that the perfect you that you used to envision. When I said you love yourself and you want to make some improvements, what would those improvements be? You couldn't improve beyond Jesus Christ of Nazareth, the most perfect human being who ever lived. When someone becomes angry over death approaching, when someone becomes fearful about leaving, departing, and what is going to be left behind, isn't it showing a little bit of a lack of faith? Shouldn't we instead, like a woman I heard halfway in here, time and time again, on KRLD, they were interviewing a lady who was in her last few weeks of terminal cancer. She was making out a new thing, something about a living auditory will. It's a new aspect to a will which says that prior to death, you may have the right to say, do not hook me up to a life support system, do not keep me artificially alive. If you come to my home and find me in a coma, just call my doctor with whom I have, you know, been treated, to whom I've gone for cancer, and leave me alone and let me die in peace. The interviewer was struck with the lady because she was up. She had a smile on her face, and she was happy, and she was not terrified. She wasn't angry. She knew death was approaching, and she wanted to die with dignity. Different approach. You know, if I could work on my greatest masterpiece, it wouldn't be a painting, or designing a beautiful automobile, or designing a building. It would be the almost urgent, emergency, almost desperate, day-by-day effort of leaving behind a far better me, so that what it is that God gathers together, because He knows how every atom is put together. He has our construction. He has our architectural plan. He has our systemic and systematic design. He is able, with His great mind, to recall the actual molecular and atomic structure that is us. Art Kelhofer can be brought back. Art Kelhofer had a character, a personality, and that personality is a spirit. It isn't just Art who could be burnt. They didn't burn Art. They just burned his body. There is a spiritual body, and we're to inherit that spiritual body, but we have a part in constructing it through the Spirit of God.